Watergate Hotel opened to the public on April 1st, 1967. Hotel rooms could be rented by the month or by the day. The marketing copy leaned on its highbrow Washington Insider decadence. We're exploring the Watergate complex on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two-bedroom presidential suites were available for $900 a month. 40 years later, the furniture and souvenirs of the hotel were sold in a liquidation sale as developers converted the building into co-op apartments. That is just a tiny taste of its history. Joseph Redotta splits his time between D.C. and California as a writer and political consultant. He worked in the Reagan administration and as a top advisor to California governors Arnold Schwarzenegger and Pete Wilson. His new book is The Watergate, Inside America's Most Infamous Address. Joseph, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kate.
Well, your book has so much scene setting going on, giving me a sense of the feel of the comings and goings inside the Watergate. And as I turned each page, I never knew what character I might run into, whether it was a congressman, a judge, a political aide, or a journalist. Can you give us a sense of the complex itself, what this property looks like, feels like?
So, sure. The Watergate is actually six buildings. There are three co-op apartment buildings, and they're each independently run by the residents. There's a hotel, as you mentioned, and there are two office buildings. There's the office building on Virginia Avenue on one side of the complex. That is where the 1972 break-in took place. And then there's another office building adjacent to the Kennedy Center. And I would probably point out that it's like a, it was intended to be a city within a city. So everything is within walking distance. It was designed so you could stay on campus and have everything you need. You could go to work, you could go to the Safeway. Back in the day, it was very, very chic to have a Safeway on the ground floor. There was a bookstore, there was a florist, a liquor store, the beauty salon, the barber shop, everything you needed right in one place. It's also a very dramatic building. It looks like nothing else in Washington.
Well, including three psychiatrists, you note in your book as well. But let's talk a little bit about this building, because it almost didn't get built. You go into great detail about the contractors involved and even how the Vatican was involved in this building project. Can you help us out with that?
Yes,
connecting the Vatican and Pope Paul VI, how the Vatican got caught up in this.
It's an unlikely part of the, it's a surprising part of the Watergate story. So the company that developed the Watergate was this great historic company called Società Generale Immobiliare. The company is known mostly in the media as S by its initials, SGI. And this was a company based in Rome, the biggest developer in Italy by far, and also very active throughout Europe. And they were looking through the United States for a project and settled on this parcel of land, which was along the Potomac River. And it's in between Georgetown and the Lincoln Memorial. And as it was going through the permitting process, the building had to navigate a very complicated regulatory path, had to get through the city with Washington, D.C., which was very supportive, but they also had to get through two different federal commissions, and they were very negative. And in the middle, and the reason they were negative is because they, the people on the appointees on that board thought the Watergate was design was too big and too tall, too large, just and too modern in some cases. But in the middle of this regulatory process, the Washington Post reveals that the number one shareholder in this company is the Vatican. And in fact, the Pope had placed on the board some key associates. And so this blows up the whole conversation in a new way. It lights up, this news lights up the Protestant network. There was a network called of Protestants who were very suspicious of the first Catholic president, John F. Kennedy, and they launched a letter-writing campaign against the building, charging, among other things, that Kennedy was standing by or was encouraging really like the desecration of Washington in order to enrich the Pope. And this sparked deep concern all the way up to the Oval Office.
There were a lot of competing hands, too, in the design of the building. As you mentioned, that there was a feud between how tall one of the Watergate buildings could be in adjacent to the Kennedy Center. Who could be taller? But you also mentioned this construction nightmare, 2,200 exterior wall panels in 100 different sizes and shapes. How did engineers put this whole puzzle together, this whole architecture nightmare?
There are no right angles in the physical structure itself. It is this flowing, it's intended to be this flowing gestural expression along the waterfront. I mean, inside the apartments, there are square rooms, but the exterior walls are all angled in some way. And so this was perplexing to the American designers. And one of the things, Kate, I think for your listeners to make clear, this is an Italian building designed at sort of the height of Italian style worldwide. So this is the era of Fellini, the era of Sophia Loren, Oleg Cassini designing gowns for Jackie Kennedy, and Spumoni ice cream, sort of sweeping middle-class American dessert choices. So the American builders who had this really difficult task of taking this wild Italian design and making it possible to build that in the United States, they had to go to IBM for help. And so I found in the IBM corporate archives the file on the Watergate. So IBM helped the developer, the builders, which was an American construction firm named Magazine Brothers, helped them find a suitable computer that could be programmed to design the floor plans, design the layout of the exterior aggregate panels, the glass, and eventually come up with an algorithm for computing what the price of an apartment should be. And it was the same computer that was in use at that time at NASA. So in a way, the Watergate is the first CAD/CAM computer-assisted designed building in America.
We're talking right now with the author of the new book, The Watergate. Joseph Redotta is with us, and you can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of when you hear Watergate? What memories do you associate with the buildings or the scandals that took place there? What questions do you have about the Watergate and the complex? Do you see any resemblance with the history of Watergate to today? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joseph, there was some really amazing marketing copy that is in your book, that there was a brochure for the Watergate South apartments. Of course, there were these showrooms, so trying to sell all of this real estate, get people in these apartments. The copy was magnificence, flair, saunas, an outdoor cafe, parking, restaurant, wining, dining, a sinfully good pastry shop, a marvelous little hairdresser, security, intercoms, and a bidet. So, well, you know, they were really trying to sell this because this is a lot of real estate going up in D.C. Is that right?
Right, and it was a new option for living in Washington. In fact, there's this amazing Life magazine story from 1969 where the headline was, "It used to be Georgetown, now it's the Watergate. Just everybody lives there." And so you picture in the sort of conservative Washington town, an Italian building with these massive apartments, and they were marketed as like the latest way to live, the most modern way to live. You're trying to draw people away from the suburbs back to the city. And the two pillars, really the two pillars of the marketing campaign were luxury and privacy. And that was the brand of the Watergate up until June of 1972.
Which, of course, is when we get the Watergate scandal and smoking gun tapes and all. Before we get to that, though, you give us a really interesting glimpse of single women working in the 1970s who are able to afford their own apartment in the Watergate. Maybe they're working on Capitol Hill. Maybe they're an aide to President Nixon. What do we know about these women finding a home in the Watergate?
So at the time, for a single professional woman in Washington, there weren't really a lot of options. You could live at maybe like an all-woman apartment building that was like sort of almost like a dormitory. You could live in a apartment that maybe had been constructed in or before World War II, rent a studio or something like that. But if you wanted to own something, you really, as a single a woman, there weren't a lot of options. And the Watergate offered ownership to buyers and for apartments as small as what was called at the time a junior one bedroom or a studio. And the price point was quite reasonable. It was $17,000 in the first building for the least expensive unit. And so a lot of that first wave of professional women in the Washington workforce, a lot of women bought into the Watergate, and it provided them a stylish place to live. It provided them convenience. People could get to work at the women could get to work at the State Department, for example, which was just a few blocks away, and it was also very secure, and that was quite attractive. And so, among other women who were among the early buyers of the Watergate, was the future Elizabeth was Elizabeth Hanford, who at the time was an aide to President Johnson in the consumer branch, and she ends up becoming married to Bob Dole, and she becomes a United States Senator. So Senator Elizabeth Dole was one of the first women who bought at the Watergate.
Here is a moment from Joseph Redotta's new book, The Watergate. The story comes from a Watergate hotel receptionist. Watergate attracted foreign diplomats. Three guests from North Korea check in one night. During their visit, the FBI rushes in. The North Koreans are missing. The North Koreans were actually just sitting in a corner of the lobby, and this front desk clerk discreetly pointed that out to the agents. Getting your questions on the Watergate, the complex, the scandals, 800-642-1234. Have you been to the Watergate complex in D.C.? What do you make of it? I know I walked by when I was on my way to the Kennedy Center once. I didn't really pay as much attention to it as I do now, as I would have if I had read this book. Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters, Watergate office complex, June 17, 1972. President Nixon's administration tried to cover up its involvement, resisting a probe by Congress. Let's listen back to the secretly recorded conversation between President Nixon and his aide, H.R. Haldeman, 6 days after the break-in. It reveals the president's involvement. The tape is known as the smoking gun.
On the investigation, the FBI is not under control because Gray doesn't exactly know how to control it. And they have, their investigation is now leading into some productive areas because they've been able to trace itself, but to the bank.
The book is The Watergate, Inside America's Most Infamous Address. Author Joseph Rodota stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you stayed at the Watergate Hotel? What do you remember about it? Did you have meetings there? What do you want to know about the history of the Watergate complex? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joseph, you write this book to present an entirely new way of looking at the Watergate, but can you explain how Watergate is perceived today? Because many people associate it with the Nixon administration scandal, with the break-in, but it's complex in how it is viewed today and what happened during the Nixon administration.
So, about a year before the break-in, the Washington Post wrote an article about the Watergate and referred to the building as a glittering Potomac Titanic, comparing the Watergate to the ocean liner, and they meant it as a compliment. They meant it was this place of luxury with this incredible cast of characters, incredible passenger list. And they said, the Post said that there's a difference, which is, included, there's no steerage class, and there's also no iceberg. And of course, a year later, there is an iceberg that changes, which in the form of the break-in, changes the Watergate's identity forever. And so, as a result of the break-in and the attention that comes to the building, and Watergate becoming shorthand for that scandal and for subsequent scandals. You know, there's one Gate scandal left. No, the word Watergate now has become synonymous with a scandal and becomes a key, in effect, a key part of the identity of the building. And I try to take a different look at the Watergate era. I didn't chase the story around Washington. I try to focus on the building and its relationship to the scandal. And so I'm looking at the Watergate as if the reader is living in a one-bedroom apartment in the Watergate and watching the story unfold. And what would that person pay attention to? Well, they would pay attention to what's happening. How does this affect my neighbors? So, for example, there were many Nixon people lived there. There were so many Nixon people at one point, the place was referred to as the Republican Bastille. Mm-hmm. And you had Rosemary Woods, the famous secretary to Nixon. She lived there. You had Nixon cabinet members, Nixon's Federal Reserve Board chairman. And then there's also this idea of how does this affect the brand of the building, and now that I'm walking around town, if I live there, I live at the Watergate, and that's obviously going to get a different reaction after the break-in than before, as somebody tells a neighbor, tells somebody they meet on the street where they live.
I think Netflix should pick up your book and consider a series called The Women of the Watergate. I'm totally serious here. I was enamored by Anna Chenal and Martha Mitchell, and then later Monica Lewinsky. I mean, there are some pretty remarkable women living in the complex. Let's start out with Anna Chenal and explain how she got to the Watergate.
So Anna Chenal was this glamorous figure for decades. She was a journalist in pre-communist, pre-war China, and she meets General Claire Chenault, who was this towering figure in American military history, and the chief of the Flying Tigers, the very famous air unit that was in China. And she marries him, moves to America, and he dies of cancer. And they were married and living in Louisiana, which had anti-miscegenation laws. And so one of the general's closest advisors, the first super lobbyist in Washington, a guy named Tommy Corcoran, moves Anna up to Washington, where he thought she and the girls, the two daughters, would be treated better. And so Anna sets out. She's very, very bright. She gets a job in Georgetown, working, among other things, on developing a computer that could write, a typewriter or a computer that could write in Chinese characters. And so she, the Watergate is starts going up, and she buys one of the penthouses. And it's this massive, she actually combines two penthouses. It's this massive complex at one end of the first building. And she uses the Watergate as a platform for her personal and social and political advancement in Washington. It becomes this place where everybody wants to be seen. She throws the best parties. If you're a candidate, this is the person you want. A Republican candidate, this is the person you must know. And the party list is off the charts. It's J. Edgar Hoover comes by, senators, congressmen, and she is the number one hostess of the Watergate. And in fact, there are articles of the time speculating that the page has turned, that the era of Pearl Mesta and the old grand dame of Georgetown is over, and the new hostess of Washington is Anna Chenault. And she became very close to, she was close to Goldwater, she was very close to Nixon, and she becomes famous or infamous as a result of her activities in the closing days of the 1968 presidential campaign.
She also has some back channel conversations going on with the ambassador of South Vietnam.
Right. So the charge over the years has been that in the closing days of the 1968 campaign, Nixon and his Attorney General John Mitchell, at the time his campaign manager, fretted about the possibility that LBJ would engineer some last-minute breakthrough in negotiations over the war in Vietnam. And so the charge is that Anna carried a message from the Nixon campaign to the government of South Vietnam, suggesting that they step away from the Paris peace talks, and if they did that, then they would get a better treatment from the incoming Republican president than they could hope for under either LBJ or the Democratic nominee, Hubert Humphrey. And I found in the LBJ library the personal file of President Johnson on these weeks, including the minute-by-minute FBI reports that were being fed to him, that were the observations of Anna Chenault coming and going from the Watergate.
And you didn't want to cross her. You wanted to be at her parties. And apparently she didn't want a post in a cabinet. She didn't want a cabinet position, not in the Reagan administration and not in the Nixon administration.
Well, there are sort of two things I saw out there. Number one is over the years, everybody's coming to her saying, "Oh, aren't you in line for something big?" And she would always she would coyly say, "Oh, I'm so busy, I couldn't possibly make the time. I love doing what I'm doing." And then behind the scenes, she is launching an aggressive letter writing campaign to be named to something. She clawed hard at the White House personnel directors over the decades, looking for posts like ambassador. She wanted to be at the State Department. She wanted to be ambassador at large. Just one thing after the other, here and there she would get a small appointment, and it was really never satisfactory to her.
A lot of the details in your book haven't been made public. How did you go about gathering this never-before-seen information on the Watergate and the people inside?
Well, on the document side, we had to vacuum up a lot of material from around the country. So the National Archives held some amazing files. So I had the transcripts from the early days of the Watergate's, you know, very contentious permitting fights, and the fights between the Watergate and Jason Kennedy Center. So those were held, in some of them at the National Archives, including the transcripts of the closed meetings. So once the Watergate team would leave the meeting and the public would be excused, then I have the transcripts of how these appointees of Kennedy and Johnson, among others, would discuss the problem and what to do about it. I was looking for the files of the Watergate company, I was hoping to find in America the records of the building, you know, the memos and what have you. And as far as I could tell, they don't exist. They just were, they disappeared or were thrown away. But I found the files in Rome. As I mentioned earlier, the company that built the Watergate was based in Rome. It no longer exists, but before it closed, the files were shipped over to the Italian government, and they are now preserved at what is the equivalent of the National Archives of Italy. And so I found in Rome boxes and boxes of memos, telegrams, and board minutes, most of them in Italian, discussing this new opportunity, which was at one point just referred to as the Foggy Bottom Project, and then all the way through the process, including these memos back and forth, reporting on how the leases are going, how the sales are going, and the arguments between the Italian architect and the American interior designers, the American architects. It was fascinating. And then what's interesting also at the time, this is the Watergate scandal is unraveling in America. There is this this scandal races through Italy and touches at this company in a very, very real way. And so I found for the first time in the book, reporting the inside story of this company in the 70s and in what was known at the time in Italy as Italy's Watergate. And it was exciting for me as a writer and researcher to be in the archives with this materials, because when we opened the boxes, the rust was still intact on the paper clips on these memos. Yeah. And at the end of the day, my desk was covered in rust. And from so that was a good sign. We were the first people to look at any of this in decades.
Author Joseph Redotta stays with us, and his new book is The Watergate, Inside America's Most Infamous Address. Do you have a question about the Watergate and the people and the property? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joseph, found a bit of Wisconsin in your book. There was a Wisconsin lawmaker, William Proxmire, who exposed wasteful government spending connected to the Watergate in connection with Anna Chenault's parties and Northrop involved. What did Proxmire find out?
So this is an interesting part about the Watergate is really there's a connection to every place you can imagine in the world, right? It's you know, so many amazing people from everywhere. It is revealed in a defense contracting agency audit that Anna Chenault, so Northrop has submitted for reimbursement under one of their defense contracts the entertainment expenses of Anna Chenault at her penthouse at the Watergate. And in this blow, and of course, Senator Proxmire, he's at the time, he's always on the hunt for things like this. And so it sort of sweeps through Washington as one of the big scandals of the day, that these parties that you've been reading about in the style section, well, guess what? You've been paying for them. And this leads to a massive audits across the board of all defense contractors. They see there's a pattern of this, that entertaining expenses are being charged against government contracts. And so Northrop has to refund the money. And I found in the archives instructions to Anna Chenault about, you know, making sure in the future that you don't submit these as part of your you label everything appropriately, because we don't want to make this mistake again. But at the time in the press, she sniffed, "Nobody pays for my parties," which of course turned out not to be true.
In February of 1970, nearly 600 protesters marched on the Watergate, shouting 2468, liberate the Watergate. What were these protesters upset about? What were they protesting?
So this is related to the conviction of the Chicago 7 protesters. So the activists who were convicted of crossing state lines in order to protest at the 1968 Democratic Convention. And it's one of the first Vietnam-era protests that really lights up Washington. And they aimed their anger at the Watergate because so many Nixon people lived there, and most importantly because John Mitchell, then the Attorney General, and his outspoken and controversial wife, Martha Mitchell, lived there. And so the Watergate is the focus. And I have in the book a great photo of the protesters being arrested, and there's this sort of police protester melee going on, and behind them looms the Watergate. And then it was interesting reading from the perspective of the building residents. The bakery is sending up lemon bars and Fig Newtons for the police, and some of the residents are watching from their balconies. One resident says she's frightened. She brought all of her wooden furniture in from the balcony because she's afraid she was going to be firebombed. Somebody else, I think, was out with watercolors, was sketching the scene. And Martha Mitchell was very upset because this was a protest about the Democratic National Committee. And so she told a reporter, well, I don't see why they're here. This has nothing to do with us.
But they're still able to carry on with their own lives inside their homes and the whole complex of the Watergate complex, because they have access to all of the shops and things like that. And the bar stays open.
The bar stays open. And of course, the place is surrounded with police. The DC police just take care of it. They have people on the roof. They form this barricade around the building. And at the bar, one of the residents says to another, well, I wish we had more police protection like this when they broke into my car in the parking lot.
Oh, right. Do you see any parallels to today with protesters outside Trump Plaza and buildings owned by the Trump Corporation?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting parallel, because probably the closest thing in contemporary life to what it might have felt like living at the Watergate in the Nixon era is that the brand of your building has changed since after you bought it. So you bought into a place with X, Y, and Z expectations of how that building might be perceived to others, and then an event outside of your control reshapes your address, and you have to live with it. And so that's what happened to Watergate residents. They were, regardless of your party affiliation or if you're involved in politics at all, you're now living in this Republican branded building, and the building is being targeted pretty aggressively. And then that's 2 years later, it gets even worse with the for the residents in terms of the brand being reshaped and becoming basically a crime scene. So most people in America who probably had never seen the Watergate, an image of the Watergate ever, and then after the break-in, they're seeing it on the news constantly, and it's usually just a shot of the building, as part of an intro to a network news program about the trial or the investigation, or maybe it's like a black and white photo in their local newspaper about a crime scene, and that becomes sort of this indelible image of the Watergate, in popular culture.
After the Watergate scandals in the 70s, Congress passed a series of laws to reduce the influence of big donors in politics and to increase transparency. The deep pockets that frequented the Watergate Hotel maybe had an apartment in one of the Watergate buildings because it was such an easy commute to the White House and Capitol Hill. The new book is The Watergate: Inside America's Most Infamous Address. Joseph Redotta stays with us. What questions, what curiosities do you have about the Watergate complex? Have you wondered about its association to the Vatican or its tenuous relationship with its neighbor, the Kennedy Center? If walls could talk, we're as close as we can get right now in the book, The Watergate. Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Go ahead and tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the politics and the people of the Watergate. The six-building complex will forever be joined at the hip to the word gate, morphing into new words for various scandals through the decades. But on June 23rd, 1972, President Richard Nixon met with Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman. He talked about the progress of the FBI's investigation into the Watergate break-in, particularly efforts to trace money used by the burglars. The recording of that meeting became known as the smoking gun tape. Let's take a listen to that.
The way to handle this now is for us to have Walters call Pat Gray and just say, stay the hell out of this. This is this business here. We don't want you going any further on. That's not an unusual development.
The new book is The Watergate Inside America's Most Infamous Address. Author Joseph Rodota is a political consultant. He worked in the Reagan administration as a writer and communications manager. He served as a top advisor to California governors Arnold Schwarzenegger and Pete Wilson. You can join in with your questions about the Watergate complex and your remembrances, especially at 800-642-1234. What are you curious about in the way this property is so wed to American politics? Send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Matt now, who joins us from Waukesha. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. I had a simple question regarding the Watergate. As far as the name Watergate became kind of synonymous with scandals, but then we add gate to the end of every other scandal, like the Deflate Gate or Whitewater Gate or anything else. I didn't know if the author had any insight into why we've added gate onto the end of every other investigation.
So that's a great question. So William Sapphire, the famous New York Times columnist, came up with this idea of they called it the gate construction. And it's this idea that to signal that something has become an archetypal scandal, we can attach the word gate to the end. To the end of the word. And I tell the story in the book of the first gate scandal after Watergate, and it was called Winegate. And it took place in 1974 in France. There was a widespread scandal in the wine industry related to mislabeling and various crimes related to the falsification of French wine, threatening the brand of French wine worldwide. And the center of the scandal was a gentleman who was quite offended. He said he was being railroaded by the leftist press, and he thought he said, I'm the Nixon of the wine industry. And by that he meant he was a victim of a left-wing press, and one of the reporters, French reporters at the time, who gave the scandal the name Winegate, thought it was a really terrible analogy if he was trying to prove his innocence. So the Gate scandal appears over the decades. There's one probably every week or two now. And a couple of them took place on the Watergate campus. One is, I tell the story of Hooker Gate, which was the name given to a scandal related to the supplying of drugs and prostitutes to a member of Congress in order to get his assistance on defense contracts. And then there's the famous Korea Gate scandal, which was in the 70s, where a man named Tong Sun Park, a lobbyist, was working with the South Korean CIA to influence Congress, I think related to arms sales. And he later says that he was inspired to set himself up as an operator, and he patterned himself after Anna Chenault, who had been a very successful advocate for Taiwan, and using social skills and her apartment and entertaining as a way to get into sort of the fabric of Washington and be able to then line up support for South Korea.
Matt, thanks so much for the call. And Joseph, it should be known that the Watergate, the complex, was not a diverse place, that I think the first encounter we get with a resident who is an African-American is a vice president at the Export-Import Bank. So how did the builders and the co-op associations try to keep out people of color?
Well, it's I wouldn't say there was no effort to keep anybody out. It was not an inexpensive place to buy, and there were co-op apartments with very high down payments, so that worked against a lot of low-income buyers. I did find in the records in Rome, there was a concern in Rome about the District of Columbia's fair housing laws, and they asked two different the Roman headquarters staff asked two different American real estate agents for their assessments and advice on whether the fair housing laws would affect the building in any way, and the report came back that they would not, primarily because of price. But what I also saw in going through the stories of the early residents, the Watergate attracted a lot of people who were very progressive on race issues. There are several people who left Northern Virginia and moved to Washington into the Watergate because they were tired. They were really unhappy with the racial relations in Virginia. There was this one family that said, we had African American friends and who are friends of ours, and we couldn't invite them over for a weekend to swim in the pool in our community, and so you have in the Watergate, sort of a progressive community on race issues. There are African American owners over the years, but it might just be probably a function of price and time. The African American Senator Brooks, Edward Brooks from Washington, from Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Lived there across the hall and down the hall from Rosemary Woods, Nixon's secretary. But and there's a funny story in the book about how he was suggesting to Nixon in person that he resign. And then later that night, he opens the door, and Rosemary Woods is standing in his door jamb, yelling at him.
Let's go to Cindy now in Madison with a question. Hi, Cindy.
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead.
My question is, what has become of the Watergate? I guess I have two questions. I'm going to squeeze the second one in, but the first one is, what has become of the Watergate? And the second one kind of connects to the guy that called before me, who was asking sort of about the etymology of the name. Why don't we say the Watergate anymore when we refer to the scandal? So anyways, that's my question.
Thanks, Cindy.
So the Watergate is experiencing something of a rebirth. The book covers the way to think about the book is it's a bio. I try to write a biography of the building, and take in its entire life from 1960 when the land is bought to the present. And we tend to think of the Watergate only in this limited, frame of reference in the 70s and Nixon. And in a way, it's like judging somebody by somebody's lifetime by their teenage years. The Watergate had, I would say, very, very rough teenage years. But I tried to tell the whole story. And where we are now, the Watergate Hotel reopened about 2 years ago after a very extensive renovation that does two things. It sort of harkens back to the stylish original days of the Watergate. It's this very modern, very high style, beautiful building inside and out now. And then they've also embraced the Watergate scandal, and they have fun with it. So all the coasters in the restaurants have funny history tidbits about Nixon. And when you're on hold waiting for room service to pick up, you hear recordings of President Nixon, either from radio addresses or what have you.
They're still doing the marketing.
and they took one of the two suites that were used in 1972 as the staging suites for the burglary next door. They turned one of those suites into what they called the Scandal Suite, designed by the same person who designed the Scandal TV show set. And it's a tribute to the Watergate scandal. The people still live there. The apartments are beautiful, and generally they're facing the water. It's a unique place to live. The offices are filled with companies, including the National Trust for Historic Preservation has their offices there. Beautiful offices overlooking the Potomac. It's one of the few places in Washington where you can have like sort of a campus, like almost like a Silicon Valley like place to work, and it's doing pretty well. I stayed there last week to launch the book, and has had a great time.
Well, and there's also a childcare center where the former Safeway is. Is that right?
Right. So, there. As I said earlier, it was very exciting for the Watergate to have a Safeway, and they had like an 11,000 square foot Safeway, and there was nothing more modern in 1965 than having a Safeway. And when the Safeway closes in 2011, it just is too small of a store to maintain, and it's just sort of the market just isn't there, and people start shopping at Whole Foods instead of Safeway, and then the Safeway closes. And when the Safeway closed, it was really a blow to the community. A lot of older residents were very distraught, and that they couldn't, they didn't feel that they could go to Whole Foods. It wasn't their kind of place, and they didn't have a store there and that they could shop at, and it was upsetting to a lot of the residents. And what's interesting is sort of a signal to the sort of rebirth of this place, that location for the Safeway is bought by Kindercare, that's a big child care provider. And so here, 50 years after the building opens, there's so much demand that they for childcare that they are opening up a branch there.
Well, Joseph, in the last minute or so that we have with you, do you think Watergate will remain a monumental structure? Do you see that it will continue to have that history and evolve in the future, or where does it go?
Well, the next chapters will be interesting to watch. I think it's a stunning, dramatic example of mid-century architecture, which I think is being appreciated all over America, and I think the Watergate is benefiting from that. And I'm hoping with this book that people get a chance to think about the Watergate in a new way. I had questions at the beginning of the project, like, why does it look the way it looks? Why is it there? What is it like to live there now? What was it like to live through all those tumultuous years? Why is it that the same place that housed the scandal that brought down the Nixon administration, how could that also be the same place that where Monica Lewinsky and her mother, Marsha Lewis, lived during the Clinton impeachment scandal? Oddly, Monica lived next door to Bob Dole, the man who had lost the 1996 presidential campaign to Bill Clinton. I got to interview Bob Dole. He had a whole bunch of jokes throughout that whole era. He used to say to people, where was Gordon Liddy when I needed him?
We have to leave it right there, Joseph Redotta. This has been so much fun. Joseph Redotta is a writer and consultant. His latest book is The Watergate, and it's a history of the iconic complex and the buildings and the residents who live there. This is the Ideas Network.